We've actually had quite a bit of conversation this morning about how we do what we do when we're together as a community. And that's been partly incidental. I'm finding it almost amusing at this point in the morning how much of that there's been, given where I want to go in some of my reflections here. But Cheryl came in this morning in advance of a rehearsal to help with some setup, and while I was doing some other sort of techie-ish things, she just started putting out chairs, which she just does. And lots of people who come in early kind of just, that task is there and needs to be done, and she just jumped right in. And she's been around the community long enough and knows me well enough to know that I do have an opinion about how the chairs are set up. More on that in a moment. And so she put most of them out and then basically assumed that she'd done it wrong. And so we ended up having this whole conversation about how it might not be the way I pictured it in my head, which doesn't make it wrong. And anyway, I thought it was kind of a nice conversation, but it was also really amusing given where we're going. Because the question that opens my notes is, why do we do what we do when we get together as a community on Sunday morning? The second line in my notes is, why is the room set up the way that it is? And the third is, why does somebody get up here and talk for a bunch of the time that we're together? Why does that happen? Why do we sing the number of songs that we sing? Why do we have Timbits? When I reconfigured the room into a circle a few weeks ago, the feedback was pretty interesting. I was surprised at how much commentary it generated. Mostly, at least the part that reached me, and I know over the years of kind of having leadership-ish responsibilities, I know that lots of feedback doesn't reach me unless I pursue it. But the feedback that reached me was mostly along the lines of curiosity, mostly along the lines of what's up with the circle. But some of what reached me was actually about, and this was sort of the more valuable feedback to me, was about the discomfort of change, right? It was about the relative loss of anonymity. It was about coming in and not having the experience that I thought I was going to have. Anyone who's ever been on the setup team here knows that I have opinions about these kinds of things. Some of you will remember when we shifted from this whole room facing that screen to the way that it is now. That wasn't terribly long ago. And really, like, who cares? Honestly, is this just me, like, using whatever influence I have in the community to indulge a personal preference? Is it symbolic of something? Is it an attempt to, like, get it right, by which I might mean get this thing into the shape that God thinks we should have it in? See, we were doing okay till I got to that last one, right? Don't raise your hands, but, I mean, never raise your hands at the table. That's not what I'm trying to say. Don't even go there. You do not have to signify your answer to this. But do you think that God actually, like, gives a rip how we set up the room? Whether we sing at the beginning or at the end, whether we don't sing at all, whether we have a big loud band on a high stage with a bunch of smoke and lights, or we have a nice folky trio that sits 2 feet, like who, somebody talks to us or we talk to one another, like, how much do these things actually matter? Well, if we stop and think about them at all, I think in really short order we realize that how we answer questions like that has at least a little bit to do with what we mean by God. I was interviewing somebody at a live event this past week. The outgoing president of Booth University College, who in that context of the interview was also my institutional superior. And so when I get to interview, in this case, her, Dr. Marjorie Kerr, I try to make her a little bit uncomfortable, not so uncomfortable that I'll get fired. And so in this case, she's leaving, so I felt like I had just a little more elbow room than usual. Hope she never listens to this podcast. I have till June for her to not listen to this podcast, so if it doesn't get posted till June, you'll know I was just protecting my own interests. And we really both enjoy the conversations, and the permission is given and not just taken. And so I asked her to describe her experience of feeling confident about a huge change like this, where she's leaving the presidency of one institution and going to become the president of a different one. Pretty big maneuver. And not something she was looking for. It kind of came unsolicited into her possible futures. And so I asked her to describe sort of how she thought about God in that kind of an experience. And she answered my question in a thoughtful way, and I wanted to reflect back to her what I'd heard her saying. And I said, so I feel like what I'm hearing you saying is that when you think about how God is in these things, you think about God as more like an umbrella under which we have a bunch of agency to do things, not so much like a chess master who actually, where we're the pieces, and he nudges us to a particular square. And if we resist, we end up in the wrong square, and we're outside of what God wants. And she said, yeah, that was sort of what she was trying to describe. But she also said, and this is a person with a lot of education, a lot of it theological, years of ministry experience in Christian tradition, she also said, I've never thought of it that way before. Now, the images of umbrella and chess are very particular, but the idea that God is an overarching notion as opposed to a particular interventionist notion, I was just intrigued by her response. How we think about God has a lot to do with how we think about the world around us and the things in it and what the intersection is between those two things. I want to explore this just a little bit this morning. So if you've got a phone, this will work best with a phone. How many of you, if I ask you to invite you to send me feedback with your phone, will not be able to do that? Because I have index cards as well, so we can go old school on that too, because I want to hear from everyone that wants to participate in this. So Judy, while I'm fiddling about with the nuts and bolts of this, could you just pop up that question? It's already there, way ahead of me. That's my cell number. So, by the way, I should say, if you are not someone that is in my contacts list, I won't know who you are when you send me your answer. If you are in my contacts list, I will. If that makes you feel reluctant about giving an honest answer to this question, then act as you feel is comfortable. I can give you an index card because I won't know your handwriting. So if you desire full anonymity for your answer, or you just would prefer paper to phone, just wave your hand and I'll bring you paper. Okay? What do you mean when you say God? I am going to read these out loud. There's no attempt to connect them to people, but I'm going to read them out loud because I wish for the folks in podcast land to know what sort of answers we came up with. This is already awesome. Like the stuff that's coming up on my phone. I don't know if you're having fun, but I sure am. If I was trying to locate heretics in a congregation, this would be just a complete, utter field day. I'm not. I've got heresy cornered. Okay. All right, so here's what we got so far. Keep it coming if you're still working on this. Universe, the source of all, the thing that connects everything, love, life, energy, that was one answer. Comforter, a human device to try to put to words something that is unimaginably greater than ourselves, usually given credit for why everything exists. I don't right now. The word/name makes me terribly uncomfortable. I haven't yet come to terms with, quote, a God, close quote, that I can reconcile with. A metaphor for an idea that is beyond knowability or definition, that both defines and is defined by a universe we cannot understand. God, to me, is the source of connection and love. God is the source of my belief that there is goodness in the universe. Creator, a force behind the universe's existence and form, not person, but personal, influencing us towards beauty, meaning, and morality, and also, as a separate sentence, the word love. Life, love, spirit, creator of all things, mysterious being bigger than me, and a good question. The quiet place. Dog spelled backwards. Well, that's pretty fascinating already. Having lots of different people having lots of different ideas about the same general topic or question probably doesn't surprise us very much until it comes to God stuff. And then for some reason, we seem a bit more prone to thinking that either everyone means the same thing, or at least that if everyone got it sorted and believed what we believe, they would mean what we mean. And that can sort of start to break down when we feel like we're losing our own grip on what we mean when we say God, or when we're deliberately choosing to deconstruct what we mean when we say God, or reconsider it. So on any given Sunday morning, among other times, when we gather in this community, clearly we're a collection of people that don't even think the same thing when we think about God, never mind when we try to put words to that notion. And personally, I think that's very intriguing and quite beautiful. I think it's a lot like what's going on for us as humans in general, but it's also something that for a complex collection of reasons, we sometimes pretend is not the case. And I love being part of a community where we don't have to pretend to all believe the same thing. To me, that's close to the essential richness of this community. And having said that, I also know that it can be quite disquieting, especially if there is still a voice inside of us that says something like, yes, but there is a right belief. And if we don't have it, then we are fill in the blank. We're lost, we're condemned, we're deluded, we're deceived, we're outside. This can all be incredibly complicated sometimes. It could be complicated cognitively, socially, it can be complicated emotionally. I frequently have conversations with people in which I find that we can speak freely about how their mind is changing, about something having to do with their worldview or their spirituality, but their feelings about it are another matter entirely. So when we get into something like this current exploration of the intersections between Christianity and Buddhism, I know that there are some of us that will be able to get our heads around some of the ideas, but whose hearts will be yelling at us that what we are thinking is just wrong. And that can be a very disconcerting place to be. And that's all without even taking into consideration what can happen in our imaginations if we grew up in a more, let's say, a more enveloping religious family structure, for instance, and we try to imagine having conversations with our parents or families of origin about things that we might be presently considering inside of ourselves or with a few deeply trusted fellow travelers, if we weren't already kind of jangling, you know, that little imaginary journey can put us on tilt. If you were here last week or if you listened to that podcast, you might recall me reading the opening paragraphs of Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Living Buddha, Living Christ. And in that section, he writes, and I mentioned this last week, he writes, when we believe that ours is the only faith that contains the truth, violence and suffering will surely be the result. We don't have to take a very wide survey of history to affirm that, we could just watch the news. I remember very clearly the first time I heard someone point out that it's when religions make exclusive truth claims based on the premise that God is one that they start to behave in predictably violent ways. You can chase that down on your own. It takes a bit more of a wider survey of history to kind of tease out those themes, but they're there. This is sort of a bigger trend. The idea that God is one is, of course, near and dear to the heart of three of the most successful religions in the world at this point, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, all of whom share parts of their origin stories, and all of whom, at different points and in different ways, have claimed to have a corner on knowing who God is. Now, did you just catch me talking about those religions as though they were some kind of monoliths? Yeah. I just talked about Judaism, Islam, and Christianity as though everyone that identifies with them actually believes the same thing in the same way and means the same things by the words they use to talk about what they believe, as in, Christians believe that, dot, dot, dot. If we can't pull that off in a room with less than 50 people in it, what makes us think that it is possible in Judaism, which exists within a worldwide Jewish population of over 14.5 million people, or Islam with an estimated 1.3 billion adherents, or Christianity with an estimated 7 billion adherents? Sorry. Yeah, no, sorry. 1.7. Yep, typo. Everyone's a Christian. Thanks, Jeremy. I find it very interesting that the more numerically successful a religion is, the greater the tendency to say things like, X religion believes, as though that was a defensible statement. If you've grown up in or around Christianity, you've been formed by the world's most numerically successful religion. So the odds are pretty good that that has come with some Christians' belief statements that really might not represent the facts very well, and that certainly might not represent you very well, whether you identify as a Christian or not. Sometimes it can be helpful to know just how varied the viewpoints and practices are within our traditions of origin, and how broad the influences are. So my illustrations of that idea are going to be drawn from my own tradition of origin, which is Christianity, even though I know that that isn't the case for all of us in the room. Christianity, of course, has had an enormous cultural influence on the Western world, and so I think you'll find some applicability here, even if that's not your tradition of origin. So let me give you some examples of that breadth of influence idea. You've heard me say before that I don't personally believe that Jesus came to start a religion. He already had one. He was a religious as well as a cultural Jew. And as we have these stories about Jesus' teachings, it seems likely that he had some pretty strong ideas about what needed to evolve within his own religion. And some of those ideas came at a time and place in history where they got so much traction that after his death, people began to gather around those ideas and become recognizable as followers or disciples of that rabbi, of Jesus. The idea to call that cultural or religious group Christians came from outside of the group, not inside of it, which is interesting in itself. We could, I think, and again, I'll get to the more substantial kind of parts of this, not today, but as we go, we could make the case that in the early days of this movement, the people within it weren't trying to consciously form a religion either. They were mostly just trying to differentiate themselves from the religions around them because of the ways that the teachings of Jesus pushed against the teachings of the religions around them. Alexander Schmeimann, he's a 20th century Eastern Orthodox priest, teacher, writer. He says it this way. He says, in the process of replacing the old religions, Christianity became a religion, which is an interesting idea. And along the way, it hoovered up all kinds of beliefs and practices that had nothing to do with the teachings of Jesus, despite the fact that it didn't take long for the title Christians, or Christ ones, which is what the original word would be transliterated as, it didn't take very long for that title to stick like glue to that group of adherents to the teachings of Jesus. So what most of us think of as Christianity, that's a bold thing to say, what many of us think of as Christianity contains elements of not just Judaism, which we would expect given its history, but of Samaritanism and Zoroastrianism. There's Greco-Roman ideas in there. There's Egyptian ideas in there. There's Syrian religious ideas in there. And in the earliest history of this movement, as far as we can tell, the people who were trying to sort out the implications of the teachings of Jesus for everyday life just had their conversations wherever they had them, wherever they were. After a couple of centuries of that, this group of followers of Jesus and Jesus' teachings took on some of the surrounding religious practices regarding honoring the dead, which is a relatively interesting, informative Christian indicator. If you're kind of doing anthropological work or sociological history work, this is one of the indicators about the formation of cultural ideas, is how do they treat their dead. So a couple centuries into the history of Christianity, the Christian community, as they would have been called by that point, start taking on some of these practices that have to do with honoring the dead with ceremonies and with meals, and then this leads to, over time, to building monuments over the burial places of the important dead people. And that leads to the idea of sacred spaces, what we now think of as churches, which by the 3rd century led to decorated spaces and the association of art with those spaces, hence sacred art, which led to the idea that the cross was a sacred symbol, something that didn't come into Christianity until the time of Constantine, who has this conversion experience where he sees a cross in the sky, and so then this becomes a Christian symbol. It's not till the 5th century in the history of Christianity that the crucifix, a cross with a Christ figure on it, actually comes into any information we have about the use of symbols in Christian practice. I could happily go on for quite a while about the history of how and why a typical modern church is shaped the way that it is. It's raised at the stage and lower for the people. I mean, it's a broadcast space. It's also a space that is designed to reinforce institutional authority and passive consumption of ideas. For me, that's all running in the background whenever I'm here beforehand and the setup team has me bugging them to make sure the chairs are in a curve, actually. I feel very conscious about this stuff. It's why the sacred circle outside of our room is a circle. It's predicated on a completely different understanding of how community functions, spiritually and otherwise, than most Christian churches are. It's why I personally think the community time has more life-changing potential than the talky bit. It's why I'm always looking for people to share part of their journey in this community. It's why I value these other perspectives. It's not because I don't like the sound of my own voice. My ego would happily listen to me go on at length about my perspective. It's because I don't believe that always hearing from one person is a good way to make a beautiful, diverse, courageous community of exploration. I don't actually think that's how that happens. All of this, and much, much more, points me back to the earlier question about whether or not God cares about how we set up the chairs. I can't really find it in me to believe that that's the way it works. It's more like the way we put things together point our ideas in certain directions. Space is never empty. It always embodies a meaning. Short story to close, and we're going to sing a little bit. And if you wonder why, this might help you understand how these sort of things happen in community. So last week, if you were here, you might recall that Randall and Kim led the group that made the music. Tim Penner and I played along. I usually play with Kim and Randall. It's not something Tim usually does. So when we were preparing, Randall was handing out the music, and there was some confusion about and conversation about how many songs we were going to do. And that led to a conversation about how many songs we usually do. And Tim, if I get the details of this wrong, please help me. So where we do them in the order of our time together and so on. So don't get me going on the history of the order of service or calling a gathering of spiritual community as service. That's a very clear, well-documented piece of history, but it would take another whole hour. Anyway, there's a reason for all this stuff historically. So this conversation starts going on about why do we do how many songs, where do we do them when we're kind of together in the flow of what we're doing. And Tim said something along the lines of, well, one Sunday, and Randall was like, he had 4, and then we were going to do 3, and then, so Tim said something along the lines of, well, one Sunday I was getting 4 songs ready for the end, and I just thought, we don't need that many songs, so I just did 3. And it just seemed like everybody just kind of came along, and now we just do 3. And by the time, Tim wasn't trying to make a point, like, he was just talking about how he remembered it happening, as far as I could tell. Is that a fair representation? There we go. Better yet, right? So over the summer, took it down to 3, never put it back to 4. That's perfect. So by the time I was done chuckling about it, though, I found myself thinking that's how most of what we think of as standard belief or practice happened. Somebody had an idea, they put it out there, it got some traction, and it didn't take too long before somebody said, that's the way God wants it to be. And then they found a verse that said, that's the way God wants it to be, and it was sacred. Like, there's no kind of magic to most of this stuff. if you're able to stand back from the idea that God dictated one form of religion and consider the possibility that actually what God did, whatever we think God is, that within those ideas we make a thing that we call religion. Once we can entertain the possibility that this is something we make, this examination of it turns into both a lot of fun and a lot of permission to explore what we believe. It also shifts the responsibility from sort of a passive, relatively childish laying onto us of belief and makes us responsible for what we believe. It's a more, I'm going to say, more adult version of this. Tagline, punchline, if you will. When I was in the middle of writing these ideas down, Cheryl, I have permission to tell these stories. So Cheryl, who is leading the music this morning, sent me an email with a few different thoughts about the shape of our gatherings, ways we might modify them, change the approach to music, how much we do when, what the kids could be here for, which is, you know, an important feature in that conversation. And I just, like, I was sort of sitting at my computer writing these ideas and working with them, and poop, up pops this email from Cheryl going, I really want to do a whole bunch of songs at the beginning. Like, is that okay? I just thought, this is perfect. This is perfect. It's so much fun. So that's kind of how dynamic this is in the way communities take shape, right? Anyway, which to my way of thinking brings us back to this quote from a Tibetan Zen Buddhist monk. When we believe that ours is the only faith that contains the truth, violence and suffering will surely be the result. And that makes me wonder, is that a Buddhist idea? Is that a Christian idea? Or is that just a human idea? We're gonna pick that up again next time. I'm not sure if it's going to be next week or not. It's the AGM next week. Sometimes when the AGM comes around, I feel this weird compulsion to talk about money. I might resist that. I haven't decided yet. So anyway, we'll see. But we'll get back to it. All right, Cheryl, let's do some singing. That's a lot of talking.